I'm going to declare that it's 10 o'clock. This is the hearing pursuant to the order of the New Hampshire Secretary of State dated October 5th, 2010 in the FRM matter. For the record, this is Charles Chandler, presiding officer. We have four live witnesses scheduled for today. Before we get to the witnesses, Attorney Spill or Attorney Forcia, do you have any preliminary matters?
Yes, sir, I do. On behalf of Kenneth and Jean Miller, they're here today. They've asked me to add a few documents to their set of documents, and I'll give them to Michelle now.
Can you tell me briefly what they are?
They seem to me to be some other lending opportunity flyers and letters and things of that nature. I have not had a chance to review them in detail. I also have some documents on behalf of John Bowender.
Okay. Before we get to that,
yeah.
I want to add this to evidence docket number 11. We can add it to 11. Mr. Forcey.
I've also got some documents on behalf of John Bowender, who testified last week. One of the documents is an updated version of his opening statement that he had told you he was going to add, as well as some additional documentation you spoke about on the record having to do with the title insurance.
I believe I asked for some additional documentation, and I believe he offered that he would give an amended opening statement.
Correct.
So will it... I'll accept those.
Included with the title information was an email that he sent to me, and he explained essentially what the documents are and why he was providing them. And he asked me to include my email that he sent to me before he explained it. So it's also...
Well, again, the rules of evidence do not apply. I'm not a big fan of email.
Sure. If you would like, I'm sure I'd be happy to go back on the record via telephone to explain why these documents and essentially explain the email.
Let me have a look.
Sure.
That's fine, and again, remember, the farther we get away from the rules of evidence, the less likely it is that the probative value rises. So, I'd like this added to evidence packet 35. Okay. Anything else?
No, sir.
Mr. Spill, anything?
No, sir. Okay.
With that, our first witness is going to be Brenda Ward. Ms. Ward, you understand that this is a public hearing. The matter is being recorded. You will be placed under oath, and given those parameters, are you willing to testify today?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to ask you, do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give in the matter pending will be the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yes.
And you, in fact, are Brenda Ward, is that correct?
I am.
Okay. Ms. Ward, many of the people we've had testifying over the last couple of weeks have had either a prepared opening statement that they have read into the record, or they have given from a non-prepared statement an overview of their relationship with FRM. Do you have a prepared statement of any kind?
I do.
Would you like to read it into the record?
Sure.
Thank you. Please proceed.
I just stated I am awed and humbled and a bit intimidated listening to the other statements that I've heard online, but I'll give it my best shot. If it weren't for the McAfees and Millers, I know there's no way to get to the kind of stars we have. For them, my most grateful thanks and gratitude. There are so many victims that have it so much worse than I do. My heart goes out to them. The losses are gargantuan and the heartache unimaginable. Me, this past year has been devastating, to say the least. I had dreams, as we all did, thinking all our work and investment would pay off. I could pay for my younger daughter's education, upgrade my 20-plus-year-old condo, and plan for the future. These are all things to be hoped, dreamed of, crushed. I don't have all the details that I should. When I invested with FRM, CLM, here was my situation. I was in the process of a divorce when I first invested in 2006. I was forging my way to be financially independent, having never been privy to day-to-day finances. My parents had passed away within a year of each other, 2004 and 2005, and we were left with an inheritance. My dad's friend, Ken Miller, had mentioned this opportunity in passing to my brother before my dad had even passed away. Lend money, get a great percentage in interest, no risk. If something happened with a loan, we may lose the interest payments, but we get our initial investment back. I didn't pay much attention at the time, but it worked for me and I felt comfortable and safe that my family and family friends were doing the same thing. What could go wrong? My initial investment was with Tangway. My sister and brother-in-law received my inheritance check from my brother, who was the executor of the estate, to include me in the Tangway project. Put in $100,000. All the documents were signed by my sister and brother-in-law in my name. In 2007, I switched things over a bit, reducing my Tangway investment to $75,000 and invested $50,000 in two properties for Ryan Heath, police chief of Alton, New Hampshire, along with three other investors. Payments were made, although late, through 2008. In 2009, the interest checks stopped coming. I called and emailed Scott Farah on numerous occasions, only to be reassured that he was working it and it would all be well. And however it ended up, I would get my investment back one way or the other. The last correspondence I had with Scott was July 2009 in regards to this issue. The only other time I heard from him was from his office in the fall time frame with a call to my cell phone asking if I had any money I could invest. My answer was, are you kidding me? I haven't received a check from Ryan Heath account for months and I have no money. The response was, would you like Scott to call you? Sure, no call. And just a few weeks later, the doors closed. And this was after he had convinced my brother and sister-in-law and sister's in-laws to send more money, which was cash and went to nothing.
Thank you very much. Do you have a copy of that? That we could enter into the record, I would like to do that. I find the opening statements very helpful.
This is hers.
Let's get three copies then at some point. Mr. Forsey will get that. We'll leave one with you and I'll take one and the lawyers from the Bureau. First, let me thank you for taking the time to come here today. It's not easy, and I understand that. You indicated in the direct testimony that your first contact with FRM was as a result of a referral. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Did you ever receive any documents in the mail from Scott Farrar or FRM?
Previous to my investment, no.
Okay. You never received, is it fair to say that you never received anything characterized as opportunities?
That is correct.
Okay.
Until after I invested.
And subsequent to the investment, did you receive something called opportunities?
Yes.
And what did you understand these transmittals to be? What did it mean to you?
If we had more money to invest, there were opportunities, and to contact him, we'd get it, or I'd get it probably once a month, big package in the mail.
And is it fair to say that you'd review that package and see whether it made any sense to you?
I didn't have any money to invest, so I didn't
look
closely.
Okay. But you did invest money with FRM?
Yes.
Invest is your word, is that correct?
Yes.
Did you think at any time that monies you forwarded were in any way going into the actual business of FRM or CLM?
I assumed that they were going to the investments that I had made, yes.
When you say investments, tell me what you mean by the word investment. Well, let me back it up. How did you forward money to FRM?
With a check. as I stated in my opening statement, initially the $100,000 I never actually saw because it was from my inheritance. And my brother just sent it directly to FRM.
Did you, when you forwarded that money, did you believe you were purchasing an interest in the business of FRM?
No.
Did you believe that you were lending money to someone that, and that loan was going to be secured by a mortgage on real estate?
Yes.
Look, some hesitation there. Is it fair to say you're not familiar with financing of real estate acquisitions or constructions, and this was an opportunity? Let me ask the same question in a little way. Did you feel that your $100,000 was protected in some fashion?
Yes.
Ah. And how did you feel it was protected?
I assumed that FRM had that money, and if anything was to happen, that I would get it back.
Did anyone talk to you about an ability to foreclose on real estate? If nobody ever talked to you about that.
No.
But in fact, you did receive interest payments, is that correct?
Yes.
Is it fair to say they stopped in the mid to late fall of 2009?
I got the interest payments from Tangway up until September. October of 2009. As I mentioned, the Ryan Heath debacle was, I hadn't gotten an interest check for that investment since early spring of 2009.
Did you ever attend any closings where these transactions were consummated?
No.
No. Did you ever receive anything in the mail from a law firm called Gould and Burke?
No.
No. Did you ever receive title insurance policies from anyone?
I don't believe so.
Did you ever receive copies of any mortgages?
You mean the HUD statement?
No, I mean a document entitled mortgage or construction mortgage or something of that nature.
Commercial construction loan agreement.
Let me make it a little easier for you. I have a package in front of me with a series of documents that presumably came from you to the Bureau of Securities.
Mm-hmm.
In these documents are something called a second mortgage security agreement and assignment, statement of finance charges, collateral assignment of rents and leases, commercial loan construction agreement, documents of that nature. From whom did you receive these documents, if you recall?
From financial leases.
Okay. Are you familiar at all with the New Hampshire real estate recording system?
No.
Okay. So it's fair to say you forwarded funds, either directly or indirectly, to FRM with the belief that those funds were going to be secure and with the belief it involved, in some fashion in your mind, an interest in real estate. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. How did you become aware of the closure of FRM?
You mean later on Friday the 13th?
Oh. And what, if anything, did you do as a result of reading that newspaper?
got in contact with my brother and sister and Ken and Gene Miller, and Ken was able to get some information as to who to contact, over the FBI, and talked with a newspaper reporter.
Okay. I have nothing further at this point in time. Attorney Spill or Attorney Forsey, if you have any questions for Ms. Ward?
I do not.
I just have a couple of clarifying questions.
Certainly.
Thank you for appearing today. Just so I'm clear, the Tangway property, when did you make that investment?
That was in January 2006.
And you received interest payments until the fall of 2009?
Yes.
And the other property was the Alton Bay property?
Mm-hmm.
And that was, the developer on that was Ryan Heath?
Yes.
Do you know Heath?
No.
Are you familiar with the property?
No.
Are you familiar with Abbott Village, Tangway Homes?
Just what I've seen in pictures, I never actually saw it.
Where did you see the pictures?
Financial Resources would send them.
Okay, so.
Progress.
So you researched it a little bit before you put the money in?
No.
But you saw the pictures after you put the money in?
Yes,
before?
After.
Okay. And then I think you said payments stopped with respect to all of it?
Yes.
And when did they stop?
Around the beginning of 2009.
And you called, I think you said you called Financial Resources in July of 2009?
Yes, I started calling before then, asking what was going on with it, and Scott would tell me that he's trying to get Ryan in to remortgage, et cetera, et cetera. I did get, Ryan did pay 4 months worth around July. I have the paperwork here, but basically Ryan wasn't paying and he wasn't coming in to Scott's office to make arrangements. So I was constantly getting cancellation notices for fire insurance, and then they reinstated it, and because I was on the loan or whatever, it was up and down, mostly down.
So you were being
2009.
You were being notified by the insurer for the property?
Yes.
Was there a home on the property?
I'm sorry?
Was there a home on the property?
Yes, there were two homes that were being built.
Okay, were you aware of that at the time?
Yes.
Okay. I have some paperwork from you, and I believe you said that you got this from Financial Resources, right?
Yes.
Okay, was it about the time that you put the money in?
Yes.
Okay, and one says lot 166 Cynthia Drive.
Mm-hmm.
And did you say there were two properties or just one?
Yeah, 167 Cynthia Drive.
Okay, I assume that. Now, these are right adjacent to each other?
I assume so, yes.
And these were these homes completed, do you know?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, other than the cancellation of insurance, during this period of time, did you get any other updates with respect to the construction of these homes?
I did get pictures from Financial Resources. At one point, looked mostly completed, but that was it.
Okay, so you think that they weren't actually completed
right.
in full?
Right.
But close to completed?
Yes.
Do you know if either one of them was sold?
I don't believe they were.
And I noticed from your documents that there was a real estate trust involved in the transaction. Were you a lender along with some other lenders?
Yes.
Did you happen to know who those other lenders were?
I do. Let's see. They were Randy Butler, Silverthorne, Colorado, Terry Burns from Will by the Sea, Florida, Richard McDonald from Dover, Mass, and GMAC Mortgage. I can give you copies of, I've got their names on the those cancellation notices that I was getting. I can give you a copy of them.
Was it your understanding that GMAC Mortgage had a piece of this loan?
That was my assumption, yes.
Okay, did you understand that to be the case at the time that you put the money in?
I did not see that until I started getting the cancellation notices for the insurance.
Okay. Were you ever in contact with the other lenders?
Yes, I was after FRM closed their doors. I had spoken with both Randy Butler and Terry Burns. Randy was proposing that he was first mortgager or something like that. I'm not familiar with real estate terms, so.
It's fine.
Kind of went by the wayside and heard from him since.
When you got the cancellation of insurance in the mail, who did you contact with respect to that, or did you not contact anybody?
I had talked to Scott about it and Diane Smith, the office manager, with concern about that on top of not getting the interest payments. And that's, they said, not to worry about it. You know, it's just because my name was on the paperwork that I was getting those notices.
So, is it fair to say that, with respect to the Alta Bay property, was your last attempt to contact Financial Resources in July of 2009, did I get that right?
Yes.
Yes. Anything after that, like cancellation of insurance or any other reason to get involved?
No.
And Scott led you to believe that there was going to be an attempt to refinance the property?
Yes.
And that conversation was in July of 2009?
Yes.
I have no further questions.
Ms. Ward, I'm looking at some documents you provided to the Bureau, something called a Loan Master Report. Did you receive that from FRM?
Yes.
Do you know the name Donald Dodge?
Yes, now I do.
Did you then?
No.
Did you know what CLNM Inc. was back then?
No.
Now you do.
Yes.
This Loan Master Report that I'm looking at, is it fair to say it came to you from FRM?
Yes.
Okay. And it's on this printout that it shows the late payments to you?
Mm-hmm.
On the second page of that, there's a payment of $2,118.81 to Gould & Burke PLLC.
Mm-hmm.
Did you understand what that was?
No.
Okay. I have nothing further. I want to thank you very much for taking the time. It's not easy to sit there and do this. I understand that. Every witness opens the door a little bit more for me. It's absolutely true. So thank you very much. If there's anything additional that we feel we need, that I feel I need as a result of the review of your documents, I will ask the Bureau through their attorneys to contact you.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Excuse me?
Would you like to enter that into the
system? Yeah, might as well do that. 37. Yeah. Good, thank you. The second witness we have for this morning is Peter Martino. Mr. Martino. Again, Mr. Martino, you understand that this hearing process is open to the public. It is being recorded. And in order to testify, you'll be placed under oath. Are you willing to accept those conditions?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I'm going to ask you, do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yes, I do.
You are, in fact, Peter Martino. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Mr. Martino, I believe you heard me with Ms. Ward that many people who have chosen to testify as victims in this FRM matter have had a prepared statement. I noticed in your file that you have a prepared statement. Are you willing to read that into the record?
Yes, I am.
Please do.
Actually, I wanted to just speak extemporaneously, but well, I really didn't get a chance
either
to
way.
Put this together until after midnight last night. I didn't have a chance, so I'd probably do a little bit of both.
Whatever is comfortable for you.
And I'm going to read the statement, but I may go off on a tangent here or there.
That's okay. That's understandable.
First off, I'd like to thank you and this investigation for the work that you're doing. I really appreciate it. And my hope is that your investigation will shed light on a variety of issues that are involved in this whole sordid affair. I came to know Scott Farah and Don Dodds through David Kutcher, a financial planner who's the president of DAC Financial Group. Dave was a fellow Marine Corps officer whom I served with back in the 1980s out of Camp Pendleton, California. Our paths crossed again by accident in the summer of 2004. Shortly after that, I left for adventures in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other parts of the Middle East. Lost contact with Dave for a while, but then reconnected with him in the summer of 2008 after coming into a substantial sum of money. I saw that the economy was entering a serious downturn, and I wanted to buy some time before making a decision on where to invest my money for the long term. Dave could not speak highly enough about Scott Farah and his short-term loan programs. Scott told me that my money would be backed up with a first mortgage in my name against the properties in the event of a default. With high loan-to-value ratios, I felt that my money was secure. It didn't matter to me that Scott turned out to be a scam artist. It also didn't matter to me that no less than three state agencies and a government task force failed to shut down his operation despite numerous complaints to the Banking Commission and the Attorney General's office years before I even met Scott. Sure, I would have loved to have known what they knew, but once again, it didn't matter to me. The reason that none of this mattered to me is that Scott was correct. I made two loans on two separate properties. The borrowers received the money, and I am currently registered in the respective counties as the first lien holder. Some people have said that us lenders are just greedy people looking for a government bailout. We should have used due diligence before investing, and that those high interest rates should have been a tip-off of that something was wrong. And I've seen some pretty strong comments on the internet after some of the news articles that appear on this whole scandal over the past year. And it's a shame, because I first want to say that, you know, getting to know some of the other lenders, like the McIlvains, the Millers, the Gateses, the Beans, and a lot of other good people, that's been the silver lining out of this whole ordeal for me. These are salt-of-the-earth people, and I don't think any of them deserve some of the treatment that they've gotten in the media as well as on the internet. But I wasn't looking for anything from the government then or now. Secondary lending practices such as these are common throughout the country, and they're a vital part of the economy. As far as due diligence is concerned, a fellow Marine officer whom I've trusted with my life and who is now a financial planner seemed like the perfect individual to also trust with my money. Not only was Dave a financial advisor, but his offices were located in the same building as FRM and CLNM. And in fact, when I first met them, I thought that they were all part of the same company. I quickly learned otherwise, but figured that if anything was not on the up and up, Dave would have known about it. Also, Scott highly encouraged me to check him out at the Banking Commission and the Better Business Bureau. I couldn't imagine that he would have done that unless he already knew that he would receive nothing other than a clean bill of health, which is why I didn't call the Banking Commission. But based on other lenders' experiences, it apparently wouldn't have mattered either. Like many others, I can't help but wonder why he was so clean, unless some at the Banking Commission weren't so clean themselves. I find it hard to believe that three state agencies and an army of lawyers couldn't find a single charge to bring against Scott or Don, despite the fact that Scott was taking checks from people and looking them in the eye right up until the end of his operation. I'm not sure which that falls under, mail fraud or wire fraud, but I'm amazed that the state of New Hampshire hasn't even so much as charged him with jaywalking. Instead, New Hampshire, the live free or die state, deferred all the heavy lifting to the federal prosecutors, which doesn't seem very heavy at all. I've read that both Don and Scott were offered deals for lesser sentences in return for their cooperation. If by cooperation they mean that their willingness to plead guilty and spare prosecutors the burden of putting them on trial, then I guess they were cooperative. Since I've yet to hear of one other arrest or of any found money, I'd love to know what other cooperation Scott and Don offered. I find it hard to believe that two men acting alone could steal that much money without either the willing cooperation or outright negligence of others. Other than Peter Hildreth, who's on paid leave, I haven't seen anyone else held accountable or has any money been found. For the record, I'd like to state that I do not consider myself a victim of Scott Farah or Don Dodge, nor do I consider myself a victim of corrupt or negligent state officials. What matters to me is that I am currently being robbed in slow motion by an extortionist who was appointed by a federal bankruptcy judge to liquidate the estates of FRM and CLNM. The trustee in this case has been nothing more than a self-licking ice cream cone who exists only to serve himself and his law firm. By his own early estimates of what he could liquidate of supposed FRM and CLNM assets and the amount of time it would take to do it, there will be virtually nothing left for the lenders after the trustee receives his payments first. Many lenders, such as me, who had legitimate transactions, despite claims by the trustee to the contrary, have had the rug pulled right out from under us. He's demonized people who hired lawyers and who have challenged him. He's pitted victims against victims by claiming that the reason people will most likely receive pennies on the dollar, if anything, is because of people like me who simply refuse to roll over. Many of us have secured loans, are registered lien holders, and are fighting him in court instead of handing all of our assets over to him. When I confronted Jim Donchus on this point at a creditors meeting, he quickly backed off his comments that people shouldn't hire an attorney. What happened was I heard him talking to some of the other lenders at the end of the creditors meeting, and he started demonizing people like myself and blaming us for why things would take so long and why it was going to soak up all kinds of money if we would just stop fighting him with all these lawyers that were coming at him. And I basically jumped up and said, don't you think it's a little disingenuous to demonize people who are just trying to protect their own rights by hiring a lawyer? And at the end of that exchange, I heard somebody asking him, so you mean we shouldn't get lawyers? And he didn't want to be on record as saying that, so he quickly said, oh no, I'm not saying that. Sure, go ahead and get lawyers. FRM received a hefty commission at both of my closings. How the trustee can now claim the property as an asset of FRM CLNM is beyond me. He mentioned commingling of funds, yet both sets of borrowers in my case received the money I loaned. One set of borrowers were consistently late on their payments, at one point several months behind. In each case, I never got a check from CLNM until they received the check from the borrowers. The trustee's interpretation of commingling of funds would prove that the Social Security system must also be a Ponzi scheme. It would be amusing if it weren't so sad that the trustee obtained a temporary injunction preventing people like myself from exercising our ownership rights because the quote-unquote short inconvenience to us paled in comparison to the damage that would be done to the estate without it. That short inconvenience has been extended and the injunction has been in place for a year now. Yet every time the trustee files a motion to be paid from funds recovered, he claims that his law firm, Donchus and Nottinger, would suffer great financial hardship if they didn't receive payment. Jim Donchus had $240,000 in billable hours for 1 6-month period. My sympathies go out to his family as we enter the holiday season. I also find it somewhat amusing that the trustee found it in his heart to allow Scott Farah to keep 75% of his IRA in order to avoid quote-unquote lengthy and expensive litigation. I'd love to know how Scott was going to find the money for an expensive litigation when he was claiming to be flat broke and was staring at an upcoming criminal trial. The trustee claimed that he himself didn't really have a good legal argument to stand on, so he thought it was best to settle for the 25% for the estate. He could have at least put Scott on the bottom of the pile and have him wait like the rest of us for his day in court. I and others with similar circumstances have been offered 50% after having a fire sale in this economy of the assets that are right through ours. And basically, the economy has gone extremely down, as everyone knows, with regard to real estate. It's probably one of the worst times to sell, and yet, you know, his offer to us is he's going to sell everything, foreclose, get rid of things, and we get 50%. Anyone who's tries to challenge him on that, his approach has been to bully people into accepting his offer by challenging us to roll the dice, take him to court. He claims he'd win, and we would get nothing. But one lender has rolled the dice and is challenging him in court. The trustee seems to have no problem with lengthy and expensive litigation when it comes to that lender. She's the first lien holder on three properties, and the trustee knows it would be a precedent-setting case. He has thrown every legal obstacle in her path in order to run up her legal bills, wear her down, and postpone her day in court for as long as possible while he continues to pick off the low-hanging fruit. When I took Jim Donches to task on this point at another creditors meeting, he repeatedly tried to change the subject to an unrelated case that involved a trust, not an individual who held legitimate mortgages in their own names. When I asked why she wouldn't get her day in court until sometime in mid to late 2011, he claimed that he had no control over the court schedule. During that same discussion, the topic of another lender came up who had received 90% of his assets with the trustee settling for 10% for the estate. The reason that Donches gave is that that particular lender made his loans directly to the borrowers, and the commingling argument was gone. And Donches basically admitted that his main tool was the commingling of funds. And here was a lender who didn't have his funds commingled at all, and yet still paid the trustee 10%. And I told the lender, hey, I wouldn't have paid anything. In fact, I don't want any of his money. If you're doing that for the estate as to help us as victims, I don't want that guy's money. That's extortion. The only reason he paid the 10% was to be rid of him and avoid long, lengthy litigation. Both of my properties are currently in distress. The borrowers have walked away from the properties. One property in Texas is in the process of being foreclosed on by the county for back taxes. When I asked Donches if the trustee was going to pay the back taxes, he replied no. I then asked, you mean to tell me that if the county takes the property by foreclosure, you're just going to let it go? Well, he then replied, well, if it got to that point, they would probably step in at the last minute. The property is a single-family home on 4 acres of land that was purchased by Keith Mahundro and Stephen Rose from Marvin Schwepp. Marvin is an 80-year-old man who grew up in the house and to my knowledge, is still living in it rent-free until the project is completed. Mahundro and Rose borrowed $398,000 from me in order to purchase the property and obtain approvals to build a condo development. Marvin received $200,000 at the closing and took back a second mortgage behind me for $659,000. I believe he paid most of his $200,000 to the IRS, since in their eyes he received $859,000 for his house. This paper transaction caused the property to be reassessed, and the property taxes went from approximately $8,000 to over $21,000. The condo project got shot down by the planning board, so Mahundro is in the process of working with me to try and get a subdivision approved to build Mediterranean-style townhouses. Then the trustee brought everything to a screeching halt with his temporary injunction. Mahundro has since walked away from the property. My other property is in New Hampshire. I loaned $225,000 to Michael and Elizabeth Moody so they could build a modular home on 2 acres of land with an attached garage and a 24 by 24 foot room above the garage. The Moodys claimed that in order to get financing, Scott talked them into buying a bigger house than they wanted. That they basically wanted a small log cabin, but Scott told them that it's going to be hard to get financing for that. If you get this bigger modular home, I can get you a loan. So they were pretty disgruntled that they got themselves in over the head at the basically coercing or convincing from Scott. He also convinced them that he'd be able to refinance for them and get them a new loan once the 1-year balloon payment became due. Michael was a contractor, and he received approximately $35,000 to do a lot of the work himself. Yet, at this time, the heating system is not hooked up. The house requires approximately $20,000 worth of work in order to get a certificate of occupancy. The balloon payment was due on September 1st, 2009. They were unable to get refinancing, and I tried to work with them through Tom McNeil, who worked for Scott. After several attempts at working things out, the Moody's didn't want to stay in there. They felt they were over their head, and they just wanted to break loose from this thing. They offered to give me a deed in lieu of foreclosure to try and save or salvage a little bit of their credit and to move on. They were also concerned that I'd come after them in court, so they wanted me to sign away those rights, which I was prepared to do. I was ready to do that, but was then informed by Tom McNeil after several weeks that there was a second lien on the house for $25,000, which would have to be paid off, unless I foreclosed, of course. Scott and Tom both dragged their feet in starting the foreclosure proceedings. During a heated conference call with Scott and Tom, I learned that the second lien was held by Scott and a partner. Basically, they kept dragging their feet on this thing, and Scott was saying that, you got to pay off this second mortgage, and it's going to be real expensive for you to foreclose. It's going to take time, on and on. And so I said, okay, fine. How much is it going to cost to foreclose? And Tom McNeil had already given me an initial estimate. I forget what it was at the time. But later, when I told Scott, hey, look, I'm going to foreclose, okay? Whatever it's going to cost me to foreclose, I'll give that to the person who holds the second mortgage if they agree to go away. And he said, and he dragged his feet some more. And then finally, they came back with a more concrete figure on what a foreclosure would cost. Naturally, it was significantly higher than what Tom McNeil had told me. And I asked Scott point blank on that conference call, who holds that second mortgage? Silence on the call. So as well, actually myself and a partner. I was shocked. I could not believe it. This is a fiduciary agent who represents me, who's got a secondary lien against the property and has been stalling this whole time on doing a foreclosure. I sent an email to Tom McNeil the next day, which should be part of your package somewhere. That all happened the week before FRM collapsed. The house itself was initially appraised at $300,000. In September of 2009, when I was ready to start foreclosure proceedings, the house was valued at approximately $285,000 by a local realtor, provided it had a certificate of occupancy. The house was recently valued at approximately $200,000 and sinking, and sits vacant with no insurance and a tax lien from the county for back taxes. I realize that New Hampshire is a small state with many cozy relationships, and that you can't swing a cat without hitting a lawyer who's had some type of relationship or dealing with Scott Farah or FRM. In fact, I believe that's the reason that Donches, Nottinger, and Tamposi had to become Donches and Nottinger. I'm sure that some of the relationships in this whole ordeal are innocent, such as the trustee taking a trip to Russia with the bankruptcy judge because they're part of the same legal association, or the fact that the trustee represented the Moody's in their bankruptcy case several years ago. Those are insignificant, and they don't really bother me, but I would really like to see this investigation get to the bottom of some of the relationships that Scott had with various people in state government. When Mark Connelly held a press conference several months ago asking for an independent investigation, I was amazed at the lack of politicians lining up behind him. Numerous people have had their reputations slandered and dragged through the mud. I would think that if it were me, I'd be screaming from the highest mountaintop to shine the biggest spotlight on this mess in order to clear my name. Why hasn't that happened? I believe that one of the most misused words in the English language is the word integrity. How often have you heard someone say, oh, so-and-so has a lot of integrity? I always respond with, really? What's a little bit of integrity look like? I've never seen that. Well, apparently it looks like Scott Farah, Don Dodge, and possibly some of our public servants. The reason that so many voters are cynical and disenfranchised with government is due to a lack of integrity in so many of our leaders at every level. And I've witnessed it at the highest levels of our federal government personally. And that's one reason why I've become so cynical, so I'll apologize for that. Last year, I was in Budapest and saw cigarettes for sale at the airport. They had warning labels in several languages that simply said, warning, this product will kill you. No BS, just the facts. Wouldn't it be nice if everything came with labels like that? We could all wear shirts with warning labels on them. Politicians, banking commissioners, trustees, government agencies, what should be on their shirts? I'd like to think that mine would simply say, what you see is what you get. And what you see is a guy who's too old, too tired, and too weary to give a damn anymore about what people think. I've seen too much bullshit in my life to not recognize it when I smell it. And this whole thing stinks to the high heavens. I wish you the best of luck with this investigation and hope you let the chips fall where they may. I'll donate both of my properties to the charity of your choice if you can wrestle them from this out-of-control trustee. And for the next war, yeah, they can send lawyers, guns, and money because I'll be sitting it out. From Webster's Unabridged Dictionary, extortionist, a person who engages in extortion. Extortion, the crime of obtaining money or some other thing of value by the abuse of one's office or authority. That concludes my opening statement.
Well, I want to thank you very much for your opening statement, Mr. Martino. To be mild, quite interesting. It's clear from your opening statement, as I read between the lines and as I listen to you, that you fully understood that when you forwarded money to FRM, that your belief was, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the funds you forward were going to be lent and you were going to be secured by an interest in real estate via a statutory mortgage here in New Hampshire and in Texas. Is that correct?
I believe that's exactly what did in fact.
And that's why you, is it fair to say that's why you lent money the way you did?
Exactly.
Is it fair to say you indicated to me that because of the security interest you believed you were acquiring, you really weren't too secured? You were too worried about.
Right. The either property, if I had foreclosed at any time. In fact, one of the things that Scott told me is that out of hundreds of these transactions, he's only had three where people had to foreclose. In fact, he said most people hope that these deals fail so that they can foreclose, because then you'll get more money because you'll have the property. And based on the high loan-to-value ratio, it's actually a better deal if the people fail. I wasn't looking for anyone to fail. I was just looking for a place to park my money for a year to give myself time to think of what to do with it. Thought that was a safe place to put it. And it wasn't until the trustee got involved in this thing, who was appointed by our federal government, federal bankruptcy judge, that got me into this mess.
How did you transfer the money to FRM?
I wrote a check. I believe the check was, the check was written to CLNM.
Okay. Did you have dealings with Donald Dodge?
Well, I met him. He was the first person I met, and then he introduced me to Scott Farah.
And how did you become aware of these two specific opportunities? Were they through David Kutcher?
No, it was all through Scott. David Kutcher basically made the introduction for me to Don Dodge, and then later to Scott Farah.
Did you then, after that introduction, receive something called opportunities in the mail?
I was regularly getting envelopes, packages of opportunities in the mail, and then later he sent out a notice that you could look at these opportunities on the internet, and we had passwords to be able to go in and get more details on any of the packages. The way it was structured, if you haven't found out yet, is he would send kind of a synopsis of each particular deal, and if you were really interested, you could send for the full package, which would include the borrower's tax returns and other credit scores and things of that nature, so that you could evaluate whether or not you wanted to invest your money on that project. On the internet, you had a password that you could use to go access those very documents without having to get a printed version of them.
So as a result of looking at two of those, and I'll characterize them as opportunity packages, you lent money on the Texas project and the New Hampshire project. Is that correct?
Correct.
And in each instance, it's fair to say that you believe the money you lent was secured by real estate.
Absolutely.
So that if there were a default, you would have the ability to foreclose and hopefully recoup your loan.
I wasn't going to be the first lien holder, because that's the most secure place to be as a lender, is to be the first lien holder. And I was that in both of my instances.
Were you the sole first lien holder in both of those cases? I haven't reviewed
those. Yes.
So it's fair to say that neither of these loans were participation loans. It just involved you. Is that correct?
Correct.
When you transmitted the funds to FRM, did you in any way believe that any portion of the monies that you were forwarding to them was going to be used by them for the business of FRM or CL&M?
Only their closing fee. On the closing documents, and Scott had told me what it was, I forget, it was either 4% or 8%, and that's how I assumed he made his money, because at the closings for both of these transactions, there was a fee that was taken out for CL&M or FRM, and that was my understanding of their complete involvement as to how they would get paid. And so now that this trustee is trying to say that this property is an asset of CL&M and FRM, simply because the money passed through those companies or through CL&M. And my lawyer told me when he first looked at everything, he said, this is crazy. They got their money. They were paid. The end of relationship as far as money goes. I mean, yes, CL&M continued to service the loan, but that was part of what their fee was all about, you know, why they earned their points on the loan.
So it's your belief that CL&M was a servicing agent. Is that correct?
Correct. In fact, it was explained to me by both Don Dodge and Scott Farah that the way these transactions work, is that Don Dodge, who was in control of CL&M, was responsible for not only dispersing the funds and all that and managing the account, but also responsible for going out and actually looking at the properties and inspecting them at every step of the way, and that because there were construction loans, if they put in a bill or a claim to get so much money because they did so much work, they would go out and verify that the work was done prior to releasing any funds to the borrowers.
And that kind of a scenario gave you some comfort, didn't it?
Gave me a lot of comfort.
Sure. Is it fair to say the thing that gave you the greatest comfort in these transactions was something called loan to value?
Yes.
And you understand what loan to value is?
Yes, I do.
What is it in your...
Well, basically, it's the amount of money that you're loaning versus the value of the entire property. And so if the loan-to-value ratio is high, then basically the value of the property is going to far exceed, or at least exceed, the amount of the loan. So that if I had to foreclose, not only would I get my loan back, but there's plenty of room as far as... The value of the property itself is going to exceed the value of the loan. So even if you had to liquidate the property, you know, quickly, there'd still be enough cushion there to cover your loan, and probably then some, based on the properties that I had.
Maybe I haven't been really clear, or I haven't, and pardon me, I've got a heck of a cold. Is it fair to say that the only funds of yours that went to FRM was a fee for brokering these two transactions?
Brokering them and also servicing them,
okay,
is my understanding.
Did you ever feel in any way that you were investing in the business of FRM or the business of CL&M?
Never.
Okay. Mr. Spill?
Thank you, sir, for coming today. I want to also thank you for your service in the military to our country. It is appreciated by many. I just had a couple of quick questions for you. We had talked on the telephone earlier. I don't know if you recall that conversation or not. And I think you had told me that you were in contact with the borrowers.
Yes.
And I thought you had told me that the borrowers and you had established some kind of a relationship where you were familiar with them and they were familiar with you. And this may have even taken place at the time you were determining how to loan your funds.
No, I contacted the borrowers after November 10th when I realized that FRM had collapsed and that everything was happening. I went ahead and tracked down Mahindra up in Texas, and the Moody's here in New Hampshire, called them, met with the Moody's. In fact, my wife and I met with both of them several times, and we're trying everything to work things out with them. They seemed like really good people. We didn't want to foreclose on them. We were trying to work with them prior to that, but it was all through Tom McNeil as the mediator who was working for Scott. The people up in Texas, I contacted Steve Mahundro, I think it was around November 12th, and he had told me what had happened with the project and how he couldn't get the approvals for the condos, and he was begging me not to give up on the project. It was a good project, and he just needed some more funding in order to change focus from doing a condo development to doing these townhouses, and he still had some more engineering work to do. In fact, he had a person out there, much the same as Scott Farah's FRM, a mortgage broker. And this particular mortgage broker, I forget his name, he was out in Texas, he was ready to loan another $100,000 or $200,000 to help push the project to completion, at which point the Mahundro was convinced that once he got the approvals for the subdivision, the property would immediately be valued at over $1 million, which I believe to be true based on what this mortgage broker had told me as well. I was reluctant to go along with that because it would have meant me dropping into second position. And the only way I was willing to do that is if I at least was able to, you know, take out $200,000 of that loan for myself. They didn't think that that was going to be feasible, so it never went anywhere. And I had a friend of mine who lives out in San Antonio, and he actually went and looked at the property, met with Mahundro, wasn't too impressed with him. At the same time, he felt that the property was worth at least $400,000. In fact, I called a realtor out there, several, who told me that as a single-family home, for that neighborhood, $400,000 was a reasonable expectation. But since the transaction appeared on paper to be for $859,000, it's now been assessed at that. The real estate agent who's been involved in this from the beginning, and I suspect she was actually Marvin Schwepp, the original owner's realtor, but she was working with Mahundro to try and sell all the condos once this all came about. But her main concern every time I talked to her was about what would happen to Marvin. She said he'd grown up in the house, all of his money was tied up in this, and he had no place to go. He was living there rent-free until the condos got built, and then he would get his $659,000 back. None of that's happened. I believe he's still living in the house. I've been hesitant to foreclose because I don't want to throw the guy out. At the same time, you know, my hands are tied now with the trustee. And just something I didn't mention in here, the trustee did work out an arrangement with my attorney early on in this and signed a contract, which basically gave me the authority to foreclose, pay for insurance, pay taxes, anything else that needed to happen to maintain the property, yet any money that would come to me would have to go into a third-party escrow account and be held there until a judge determines whose money it is. And if I lose, he's graciously offered to pay me back any of that money that I would spend on these things. And if I had it, I probably still wouldn't do it because it would just be making his job easier. He's trying to liquidate everything into cash, and it doesn't really care how much he gets for these properties as long as there's money coming in. That's why I don't believe that there's going to be anything really significant left for the lenders at the end of this thing.
Now, the Moody home was in Barrington?
Yes.
And they borrowed the money to build the home?
Yes.
And it was going to be their primary residence?
Yes. In fact, they were actually living in it while they were working on it. It was a modular home, but it didn't come with a garage. Because Mike Moody was a contractor or in the construction business, he wanted to attach a garage with a large room above it. And so he built that part of the house, whereas the rest of it was just dropped there like a, you know, modular home. He never finished the addition part of it. It still needs siding. The room was never finished. They have a geothermal heating system, which was never completed or hooked up. A couple of the bathrooms aren't finished. The realtor that looked at it thought it needed probably about $20,000 just to get a certificate of occupancy. They were living in it, but now that they're gone, you know, I can't even rent it to anybody because there's no certificate of occupancy. I don't have the $20,000 to throw into it just to get that, let alone pay the taxes and insurance and things like that. The Moody's had property insurance, which was canceled when the insurance company found out that they vacated the home.
Now, on the other hand, Mahundro was a developer?
Yes.
And he was building a condominium project?
Right. I'm not sure that he was going to actually build it. I think his intention was to tie up the property for a year so that he could do the engineering work and get the approvals. Once he had the approvals on the property to build the condos, my guess is he was going to sell it to an actual builder and turn a tidy profit on it.
And you had loaned on two of the units?
No, I had loaned on the whole project. Basically, it was a four-acre land. It was a four-acre parcel on a major thoroughfare in San Antonio. From everything I've heard from people out there, it's a great location. There are condos in that area. This particular lot had an old single-family home on it. Mahindra wanted it just for the land potential to be able to build condos on it. So the loan itself was to partly purchase the property, or at least tie it up for a year, which is why he gave Marvin Schweff $200,000 out of my loan to him. The other $200,000 was split up between, on this particular case, they had an interest reserve on the loan, and the rest of the money was used on Mahindra to do engineering work, get plans and things by architects' designs so that he could put it before the planning board and get the approval to build the project.
I have no further questions.
I want to go back to a couple of comments that you made. Are you familiar with the law firm of Gould & Burke?
Yes, I am.
Did you feel at any time in these two transactions they represented your interest?
I sure did.
How do you feel? What made you feel that?
Because in the paperwork, it said specifically that Scott Farrell was my fiduciary agent. And based on my understanding of a fiduciary agent, he works for me and represents me and my best interests. And Gould & Burke worked directly for him and were paid, I believe, by him in this transaction to represent me in doing all this paperwork.
I noticed in your closing documents there were some title insurance policies accounted for. Did you ever receive title insurance policies?
I don't think I ever got copies of the title insurance policies themselves. If it's not in this binder, then
I don't see
didn't.
It.
I know Alamo Title was the company out in Texas. In fact, I called them immediately after this thing first broke out. And the woman I spoke to out there seemed very nervous and said that because it was old, she'd have to go back into the archives and research this, and she'd get back to me, which she never did. At which point, I have bigger things to worry about than trying to track her down. So right now, everything's been in a holding pattern. So I don't know what happened with those title policies or if they even exist. I suspect that they do since Alamo Title was listed on the closing documents. I'm not sure about the one in New Hampshire. I believe there was a similar situation that I believe there was a title company that issued a policy, but I never saw it.
Okay. In your opening statement, you made reference to the possibility that Scott Farah had, your word was, relationships with people in state government. Mm-hmm. Do you have any direct awareness of that?
Only from a common sense approach, looking at this from the outside and seeing some of the things that he was able to do. Just the simple fact that he was so confident and so cocky when he looked at me and said, go call the Banking Commission, find out about me, check me out. Why would somebody do that unless they knew ahead of time that that would be the case, that they'd give him a clean bill of health? Now, he may have found that out on his own just by calling them and found out that was in fact the case, but why would it be the case? If they had gotten dozens of complaints on him, why wouldn't anybody, he knew there were complaints. He had to have known that there were complaints against him. So that's one thing, and as far as the Banking Commission, I don't have personal knowledge of any particular relationships. I had heard some reports, I think, in the media that I think one of the attorneys that Scott used was also, I believe, somehow connected with Peter Hildreth, whether it was representing him for a campaign for one of his political offices that he held or for as the commissioner of the Banking Commission, I'm not sure, but I think there were a couple of those types of links just between him and Hildreth alone, not to mention, I guess, Hildreth's brother, which everybody seems to be aware of, that has had some dealings with Scott also.
Can you give me a time frame when you had that conversation with Scott Farah about go ahead, call the Banking Commission? When would that have occurred?
That would have been the summer of 2008.
Okay, good. Well, let me back up and just go over an overview of two transactions you had with FRM. It's clear to me that you advanced funds to FRM to loan with a security interest in real estate, secured by a mortgage that would give you a right to foreclose if there were any breach of covenants of mortgage, both in Texas and New Hampshire.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yes.
It's clear to me that you never believed in any way whatsoever that you were investing in the actual business of FRM or CLNM.
Correct. In fact, the county of Bexar County out in Texas is suing myself, Marvin Schwepp, as well as Mahundro and Rhodes for the back taxes. I didn't see Donches, I didn't see Nottinger, I didn't see Scott Farah, I didn't see Don Dodge on any of those documents. In fact, I brought a copy this morning, and I believe Mr. Forcier put them in the binder with the rest of the documents.
Okay. And you also testified that you believed that you were being represented by Gould and Burke, and in your closing statements, fees were paid to them. I have nothing further, Mr. Forcier or Mr. Spill.
Just one quick question regarding the Texas property.
Mm-hmm.
You said you didn't realize or find out that there was a second lien holder until September of 2009. Is that correct?
That was the New Hampshire property.
Oh, it was the New Hampshire property that there was a second lien holder.
Right.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Initially, I was told that one was for, there were two, one for $10,000, one for $20,000. But then, as it came down to the end, when I was dealing with Tom McNeil, he said that there was one for $25,000, and I didn't find out about it until after September 1st, as we started to have these discussions about foreclosure. And I believe that that lien was in the name of the SNNM Trust. It's the one that apparently Susan Farah has her fingers on, or she's the trustee for, but apparently that particular trust is scattered about a lot of these properties, to my understanding, and that's the trust that's in second position behind me on the New Hampshire property.
Thank you for clarifying that. I have no further questions.
Did your attorney confirm the validity of that second mortgage?
I believe so. In fact, I looked it up as well.
Okay.
In the registry.
So you're familiar with the New Hampshire recording system and how to access records and registries?
I accessed the one here in New Hampshire as well as the one in Texas. As soon as this thing blew up, that was the first thing I did, was research to make sure that my name was registered, and it was in both places.
And that gave you a lot of comfort, didn't it?
Sure did. In fact, when I first called a lawyer, in fact, it took me several attempts at several different lawyers who didn't have dealings with FRM. You know, and originally a lawyer that I had couldn't represent me because he had done some dealings with Scott. That's why I mentioned that there's so many. I mean, it's a small state, I understand that, but you know, I talked with my attorney the first day. He looked at my documents and he said, "Oh, you got no problem." He says, "You're the first person I've seen," and he had half a dozen clients involved in this thing, and he said, "You are the first person I've seen that actually has your name on the documents. You should have nothing to worry about." So I slept okay that night until I found out that the trustee, you know, put his arms around everything.
Mr. Martino, I want to thank you very much for preparing documents for the Bureau, for coming this morning. If, as I review the documents, there are any additional questions, I will get to you through the Bureau. If there is anything additional, please remember that you will, throughout this process, remain under oath.
Sure.
Thank you. Thank you again.
Entering
Exhibit
38.
Yeah. Good job. Mr. Forcier.
Yes, sir.
What are our afternoon schedules look like?
I believe that the next person is unfortunately scheduled for 1 o'clock, but she had indicated to me that it's Mr. Ritchie, indicated to me that he would be here a bit early, so I'm hoping to catch him and see if he's willing to go, you know, 12:30 or so.
Okay.
And,
yeah.
And the person who's scheduled after him will definitely be here by 1, so I think we'll be able to get started a bit earlier in this afternoon session. Like, I can't guarantee that. I know they're scheduled for 1 o'clock.
Fair enough. Well, let's adjourn until 12:30. With the hopes that Dana Ritchie will be here at that time. If not, we'll just relax. Okay? Okay. It's 12:33. We are on the record in the FRM hearing matter as called by the New Hampshire Secretary of State. Our next witness is Dana Ritchie, but before we talk to Mr. Ritchie, Mr. Spill and Mr. Forsey, do you have any preliminary matters this afternoon?
No, sir.
There being none. Mr. Ritchie, my name is Charles Chandler. I'm the presiding officer in this hearing, having been appointed by the New Hampshire Secretary of State. The proceedings today are public. They're being recorded. If you choose to testify, you'll be testifying under oath. Do you understand those conditions?
Yes.
Okay. Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give in the matter now pending will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Ritchie, as I have explained to virtually, I hope, every victim witness who has testified so far, is that many of them have a prepared statement that they have read into the record, which is greatly appreciated. Others have not and have simply wished to address the hearing with opening remarks. Do you have a prepared statement?
I do not.
Would you like to make some opening remarks? You're not obligated to,
okay.
Anyway.
Not at this time.
Okay. Mr. Ritchie, I noticed from the file presented to me by the attorneys at the Bureau of Securities Regulation that, in fact, you did become involved with FRM. Could you tell me when your initial involvement was and how that came to be?
Sure. We moved to the Lakes region about 6 years ago, and my kids go to Laconia Christian School along with the Paras. So I got to know them fairly well during that number of years that we were there together working on various projects and all. Never really knew what he did, but was just an acquaintance. My computer guy that runs the computers for my business also runs the computers for his business. And he was over at the office one day and he said, you know, this is a great deal. This, you know, and I was questioning what actually did Scott do in his business. And he told me exactly what he thought he did. And I said, well, that's interesting because I'm looking, I had some money and I wanted to invest it. So at that point, I went up and visited him and my wife, and we had about an hour meeting with him, and to me it was very straightforward, what he did and how he did it. I left there, and I did some checking, and went to the Better Business Bureau, checked out Google. I didn't find much on them, any problems. Even had a relative of mine that's in the mortgage business call, and he was going to sign up and be one of his brokers. He said, yeah, it seems pretty good. And I figured a long-standing relationship. I mean, my network, I knew him since he was a baby, 15, 20 years. So I had no doubts that what he did was, he couldn't do what he's doing for so many years without someone knowing. So we invested $50,000. I don't know, the date was late October. And then another week later, we did another $50,000, which I think was right at the end of October. And the first time I met with Scott, and we very cordial, and I knew of him, took me through the process. And then the next time I met with Don Dodge and spent about a good half an hour.
When you said October, you mean October of 2009, is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And you indicated in response to an inquiry that Scott Farr explained his business to you. What did you understand his business to be?
It more came to light because we tried to refinance our house during that time, and what happened was that we didn't have enough equity in it, so I would have to come up with a lot of money. So if I could not borrow it the conventional way with a regular bank, then I would go to what they call a hard money lender, which was what he was. So I understood that not everybody can go to a regular bank and with the regular terms. So he explained to me that he had a lot of projects going on. He had a lot of people who were in a situation like mine, for whatever reason couldn't get regular financing, that were looking to borrow money from him and do their either homes or subdivisions or whatever.
So are you telling me that you were both a lender and a borrower with FRM?
No, I was not. No.
You were a lender, though?
A lender.
In two amounts of $50,000, is that correct?
That's correct.
What was your anticipation when you forwarded that those two $50,000 payments to FRM?
Well, what was supposed to happen was this was going to go into an escrow account, and as soon as the particular, I don't know what you call it, but the particular thing that I was investing in was a deal down in the Nashua, or Litchfield, actually. And as soon as, I think it was $230,000, so as soon as the money went into that, it hit the fully funded, then the papers would be drawn up and we would be on the title and things like that. So it was just collecting the money until the deal closed.
You just used the words escrow account.
Yes.
Did anybody at FRM or CL&M ever use those words with you?
Yes.
Who would that have been?
Both of them, both Scott and Don.
And that's, when you say Don, you mean Don
Dodge? Don Dodge, yes.
Okay.
Can I just clarify, you say investor. I was loaning the money and I was going to get a return of interest. I wasn't going to partake in any ownership other than, I mean, I was just using the money for that.
You have just anticipated a series of questions I was going to ask you. Is it fair to say that you felt when this money was advanced to FRM that it was a loan to be secured by real estate? Is that correct?
Oh, there's no question. No question. We talked about loan to value. We had appraisals there. Everything was drawn up just as if I was buying the place, as if I'd done with my house.
So did you actually see these appraisals?
Yes.
And did you reach a conclusion that the loan to value was reasonable for this money to be advanced?
Well, according to the documents, yes.
Okay.
I mean, I couldn't tell you if the appraisal was real. You know, I could just go by what he gave me.
Based upon what you saw, is it fair to say that you found the loan to value to be reasonable?
Yes, to the best of my knowledge, okay. Sure.
Is it also fair to say that neither of these two advances came to pass in a loan that actually closed?
Is it fair to say yes?
Okay.
Because yes. Yeah, it was a week later, and it's the last time I talked with him.
How did you become aware of the FRM closure?
The few phone calls that I had called Scott, he always took my call. So I took the family on a vacation to Disney World. I gave them the money, I think it was on a Wednesday or Thursday. We got on the plane on Friday, and we went. We came back, and I had nothing, and I waited. It was Monday, that following Monday. I don't have the dates in front of me. It was a week after they had closed. I checked the mail, and I said, there's nothing in here. So I picked up the phone, and I said, hey, you know, I wanted to talk to someone. I think the phone was just ringing and ringing and ringing. I said, but that's not like that. There's 60 people working there, someone. So I got a little nervous. I just said, this is very odd. So I called my network guy, and he would, you know, he was in touch with them daily, and I left a message for him. It wasn't until that afternoon that he said, I have to come over to your house. And I said, what's the problem? And he said, well, there's a big problem. And I said, well, what are you talking about? And he said, well, then he started telling me. And this was Tuesday evening, about 8 o'clock, he came over. And I said, it's Tuesday. This happened, he was up there Thursday. And I said, out of courtesy, why didn't you call me? And why did 5 days go by? And I said, and why did I have to call you? You knew I was in on this. You recommended me get on this, you know. And there was just, he couldn't answer that, you know. I know he was up there. I know people were hauling stuff out all weekend. In fact, they were hauling stuff. So I went up there Wednesday afternoon, and they were still taking stuff out on Wednesday.
Do you know who was taking stuff? Taking stuff out?
I don't know their names. I know who I talked to. I talked to, I believe it's Michael Burke. He was there. And I met him that night, and then there were the Baldy couple, and then there was another woman in the back, below that. I think the front secured. I mean, they had a paper on front, said we're closed or something like that.
Was it your impression that the people who were removing things from the offices were people associated with FRM or CL&M?
I didn't know who they were.
Okay.
I didn't know who they were. But according to my network guy and them, people have been taking stuff all weekend.
In your initial discussions with Scott Farr about these two loans that you made, you've indicated to me that the description to you was that they would accrue, loans would accrue to reach the point of, in, I think in your case, $230,000 so that the loan could be fully funded. Did anyone ever express to you that you would be receiving interest payments between the time you forwarded money and the time the loan closed?
No, no, because I said, when do you start receiving interest? And they said, once the loan closes, then she would start drawing the money and start paying the interest on the money. So the checks would start coming. It was any day that the loan was going to close.
And is it fair to say you instituted civil litigation against FRM,
yes.
CLM,
yes.
Scott Farah, and Dodge, and others?
Yeah, I called my attorney and I said, I don't know what to do. He said, let's just get our hat in the ring, and that's what he did, and that's where it stopped.
Yeah. I have nothing further at this point, Mr. Spill.
Mr. Ritchie, thanks for coming. I just have a few questions for you. Jeff Spill from the State of New Hampshire Bureau of Securities Regulation. Who was the lady that you spoke to with respect to the interest question that you had when it began?
It was Scott.
Scott said that?
Yes.
Said it would start at the time of the closing?
As soon as they closed and she drew the money, then the interest would start.
And which properties did you loan on?
It was Jessica Manukian down in Litchfield, New Hampshire.
The property was located in Litchfield?
That's what the documents say, yes.
Do you know who that actually was?
I don't. I do now, but I didn't.
Who do you understand that person to be?
A developer down in the Nashua area.
Okay, and the fellow that set up the computers for Scott Farah, what was his name?
Ryan Barton.
And the name of his business?
It is today, it's Mainstay Technologies. Then it was Paradigm. Something, they changed their name within the year.
And you said you went up there the Tuesday following the collapse?
Actually, I think it was the Wednesday, right, the Wednesday following the collapse.
And you said you spoke to Attorney Burke?
I believe it was Attorney Burke, yes. It was one of the two attorneys that were there.
Okay, and what did he tell you?
Well, I just had some questions like, what happened? And he looked at me and he said, well, I'd like to speak with you. And we walked out in the parking lot. And he started opening up. He was very emotional, very sincere about what happened or what he knew of what happened. And I said to him, I said, you know, I'm a nobody. You don't need to be telling me, you know, and getting into this. I mean, you don't know me from Adam. But he was very, very emotional, and he just said that I just did the work that Scott asked me to do, and this is a legitimate business. It works. There's people who need money. There's people who have money to loan, and it's been going on for years, and as far as he knew, you know, this was all fine, but he was very worried because he thought he may go to jail or at least bankrupt him and lose everything he owned because he's going to be dragged into it. And I just, out of the half an hour, 45 minutes I talked with him, I just felt that he wasn't, my opinion, he wasn't part of this at all. So.
Did you speak to anybody else while you were up there?
No, it was just the two Baldies and him.
And when you say two Baldies, do you know their first names?
Yeah, Larry and Brandy.
Who do you know Larry Baldy to be?
I didn't know the name at all. Now, he was just, I guess he was in a, they claimed that they had lost millions of dollars in this, and they said they were going to be finished and bankrupt and everything. I guess he was an investor. He was an investor, I guess is what it was.
Do you believe that he was a developer?
I know he has property up there. I have heard he has developed property, but I don't know of anywhere if they were.
Okay. What was the conversation that you had with Mr. Baldy?
I was just kind of dumbfounded like they were. They were just sitting with their hands in their head in their hands, you know, on the desk. And I was just like, what happened? You know, what's going on? And they just said Scott took off and a ton of money's missing. And they were victims of it, too. Yeah.
supposed to do with it.
Just one question, Mr. Ritchie, Air Force here, New Hampshire Bureau of Securities Regulation. What exactly were the Baldies and the attorneys doing when you got there? Meaning, I know you stepped aside and spoke with one of the attorneys afterwards, but what was your impression that they were doing there when you got there?
They told me that they were packing up the office because the authorities were going to put a lock on it, and they were helping the attorney take his stuff out.
Is your understanding that the Baldies were perhaps helping the attorneys take stuff out?
That's why they said they were there. I didn't physically see them take anything out. No one left the building except the attorney and me, but they were packing up stuff. They were emptying file cabinets and things.
I have no further questions.
In that 45 minutes that you were there, were you the only lender or borrower that came to the premises?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I'd like to go back to some of your introductory statements. And you indicated, responding, that you did some checking, I think were your words. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that you checked with the Better Business Bureau, you Googled FRM, spoke with this mutual computer guy. What did you gather about FRM when you talked with the Better Business Bureau?
There was nothing red flag, I guess you will. I mean, I guess my understanding was if you had a business and there were no problems, then it was just kind of neutral.
So it's fair to say that your contact with the Better Business Bureau didn't lead you to believe there had been complaints of any nature?
No, there was. I think if I recall back, there was just nothing there, so there wasn't any problems. No red flags, I guess is how I left it.
And when you did your Google search, did you Google FRM? Did you Google Scott Farrar?
Scott Farrar?
Farrar?
I don't recall.
Okay.
You know, I was in the community long enough, and I knew enough people that knew him very well that if there was any smell of any problem, I would have known. I mean, non-business side of it, you know, and I just couldn't believe that if there was any problem that went back years, that people that I know wouldn't know about it.
Did you do any checking with any governmental agencies of any kind?
I did not. Okay. I did not.
I really dislike hypothetical questions, but I'm going to ask one anyway. Had you received negative information through the Better Business Bureau, would you have gone forward with these two transactions?
Absolutely not. No, I look back and I really feel dumb that it happened, that I handed money over with basically a small piece of paper that was a receipt, and knowing now, I mean, it was a total trust. I mean, that's all it was.
Okay. Yeah. What's the status of your civil litigation at this point in time?
I would say it's probably just on hold. We really haven't done anything. I don't think I'm just a very small fish in this. And it doesn't seem to be any money, so I didn't feel that I wanted to spend thousands and thousands of dollars to go fight something that's not going to have a return.
Do you know why it's on hold?
I don't want to put up a $25,000 retainer.
Okay. Have you had any contact with the United States Bankruptcy Court?
No, not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Bear with me for a minute. The total sums advanced are $100,000. That's correct. And you never received any interest payments of any kind whatsoever. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And these sums were transferred by check to CL&M Inc., is that correct?
That's correct.
In mid and late October of 2009.
Mm-hmm. far as I'm concerned, I know that there was FRM and a separate CLM, but I thought they were the same. They both had the same, shared the same office. It was just a matter of keeping track, I guess is what it was. I never questioned that.
Okay. Just so I'm absolutely certain, before we conclude your testimony, had this $230,000 been raised, you expected to be protected by a security interest in real estate via a mortgage. Is that correct?
Absolutely correct. We were on the title.
Okay. I have nothing further. Mr. Spiller, Mr. Forsey, or anything?
No, sir.
No, sir.
Mr. Ritchie, thank you very much for gathering your documents and taking the time to come here today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, Ms. Johnstone is coming next. Thank you. Mr. Johnstone? Mrs. Johnstone is coming next.
Yep.
She may be in the hallway or down the hall. I'm going to look for her. She's supposed to be here at 1 o'clock.
She's probably going to be like a half hour.
She's probably going to be about a half hour longer. Her sister indicates to me that she'll probably be a half hour longer if you want to take a short recess.
Okay. We're in recess until 1:30.
Thank you.
It is 1:27. We're back on the record in the FRM matter. Our next witness, if we don't have any preliminary matters?
No, sir.
Okay. Our next witness is Polly Johnstone. You are Polly Johnstone, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Ms. Johnstone, my name is Charles Chandler. I'm the presiding officer in these hearings. These hearings are conducted as a public forum. They are being recorded. And if you choose to testify, you'll be testifying under oath. Are you aware of all those things?
Yes.
Okay. And you wish to testify?
Yes.
Okay. I'm now going to ask you, do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give and the matter now pending will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yes, I do.
Okay. And you are, in fact, Polly Johnstone, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Ms. Johnstone, as I have related to, I believe, virtually everyone who has testified, who has been a victim of the FRM matter, that if you have a prepared statement and would like to read it into the record, that is greatly appreciated. If you don't have a prepared statement and would like to just give some extemporaneous thoughts to the hearing, we'd be glad to hear that too. I noticed from your file that there is a statement. Would you like to read that into the record?
Yes, please.
Then please proceed.
Okay. First of all, good afternoon and thank you for this opportunity. I want to tell you a little bit about our involvement with FRM and CLNM, and just a little background on how we got involved. My husband, Mark, and I were lenders who funded money through FRM and CLNM. We were introduced and referred by a family friend. After, you know, my mom and dad had passed away, my siblings and I were left with some inheritance money. So when we heard about the lending opportunity, we wanted to find out more about it and what the process was. So I called Scott Fair on January of 2006 to find out more about the lending opportunities and what was involved. I checked with the Better Business Bureau and found them to have an A-plus rating and found nothing negative. I asked Scott specific questions, in particular to Takeaway Builders, in which my brother was involved with. You know, and some of the questions, you know, what happens if Takeaway defaults? And Scott said in 10 years, you know, we had two foreclosures and people didn't get their money back. Then I asked questions, who is the first mortgage holder, you or us? And he said, you are. And then we asked, you know, who holds our money until the work is done? And Scott said, CLNM service holds the money. Every time the work is done, it's inspected by the inspector. And then they would finish phase one. So, and then he also indicated it's written as a one-year note, but they can pay it off earlier. CLNM servicing company collects the money and they disperse to Tangway. There were no fees to us at all as a lender. And that Scott paid 13% interest and a check dispersed between the 1st and the 15th of the month. So, and then he also said that three times a month that there are other offerings sent in a three-page summary. If we like the transaction, then we send a full, then they would send a full package describing the opportunity and then the loan to value ratio along with the terms. Typically it was a 65% loan value. And that we were considered the bank, so we would get all the papers and listed as the lender. Then he instructed us to send a check or money order overnight certified, written out to CLNM, and mail it to them to their 15 North View Drive, Meredith address. and then we would receive our first full payment on the first of the month. So we continue to invest, and I also itemized the below the summary of the money that was lent for the different things, which I don't know.
Nope, go through everything.
Okay, so in August, I'm sorry. All right, so we our initial investment, I'm on page three right now, because I, on page three, my husband and I invested in five different projects with financial resources. An initial investment of $175,000 on January 19th of 2006 for Tangaway Homes, DBA, Abbott Village, and Concord. We received interest payments of 13% from February 6th through, February 06 through October of 09. And this was to mature on February 1st of 07. On January 31st of 2007, we were asked to sign a one-year extension, which we did. And this was to mature on February 1st, 2008. We never received any principal back, and when asked Scott Fair about it, and then in June and July of 2009, he said, "You're getting paid your interest every month, right? I can't take out your money since I don't have another investor to take your spot." And then on that particular investment, then on March 19th of 2006, we were approached by Scott Fair, a financial resources, about an opportunity of a second mortgage for another Tangaway home at the rate of 14%. And that maturity date was as of 2107 as well. We invested another $50,000. May 16th, 2007, we invested $100,000 with an interest payment of 13% for a project called Good Earth Revocable Trust of 2000, being financed by Thomas Gary Coyne. Michael Gould was named trustee, and that maturity date was to be 2108. We then invested another $50,000 for Earth Protection Systems with an interest payment of 20%. The above investments totaled $375,000, were paying interest until it abruptly stopped in October by the closure of financial resources in CLNM in November of 2009. We had also made a final investment on October 10th of 2009 of $25,000 for the Minokian Nashua development. We wrote the check to CLNM and they remailed it. We then received a letter from Diane N. Smith, the office management, stating that as of October 19th, we are holding a deposit for you for $25,000 towards lending on the Minokian Nashua, New Hampshire deal at 14%. You will be receiving 2 points at closing for this loan and 14% for the term of the loan. At the closing, you may receive a normal per diem payment and therefore regular payments until payoff date. That, unfortunately, was the only correspondence that we received, and the check was cashed on the 20th of October of 2009, and no interest or points were paid. Now I'm going to go back to page two of my notes. In September of 2009, in August of 2009, I called Scott to ask about pulling $25,000 back from our Tangaway investment to help fund our daughter's college education. And I was told that Scott could not do this since he did not have another lender lined up to take my place. I told him I felt uncomfortable with that and needed this money. And then he said, "Well, you're getting your interest payments, right? There is nothing to be nervous about, and Scott would try and find a replacement vendor." I called two more times throughout the month and asked about the status, and he was not able to find anybody to replace my money. Then the next month, in September of 2009, we were solicited heavily by Diane Smith, the office manager, and Scott himself via phone calls, emails to fund upcoming projects that would pay even more interest than previous opportunities. And this would have been the Minokian project in Nashua. And then I have an outline as quoted by my brother in an email. Said, "I'm writing, just got off the phone with Scott Fair of CLNM. Here's what he is cooking. He needs another $125,000 by tomorrow, or at least a commitment, to complete a $2 million project in Nashua. He gave me the details quickly over the phone, and I will try to transcribe them to the best of my ability. A woman is building 6 homes, and I think she said it's almost done. Her FICO is whatever, was in the low 700s. Scott has an equity firm that will buy the units when they are complete, thus ending the financing we might offer. He estimated the term of the investment to only be as low as 6 to 7 months. The terms are 14%. He's offering 1 to 2 points to complete the deal. My brother was going to send some money. He's looking for additional increments. And he called from 1-800-950-6913 and also seems to do email. I told him I would talk it over, you know, but they were sure. So anyway, we overnighted the money to CLNM to P.O. Box 1633 in Meredith, New Hampshire. We were in Korea when the collapse of FRN happened. We learned about this upon our return on November 15th, 2009, or thereabouts. So as you can imagine, it was a nightmare trying to get answers on who would assist us. I did a lot of research on where or who to turn to and was given the runaround. Nobody was taking responsibility or giving us direction. We contacted the New Hampshire Banking Department, who in turn referred us to the New Hampshire Attorney General. And I also included an email from another source of information that we were told. And it was from Detective Icon, suggested that we fill in a state consumer complaint form that could be found on the New Hampshire government banking. So I used Google to find the site, and then I actually filled out the complaint form. We did this only to be notified that this is not their responsibility, since we are lenders and this is only for borrowers. So we also called the Meredith Police Department, the Securities Commission, Jeff Spill. We called Shaheen and Gordon because they were on the website, and spoke to Cindy Warrington. And they said that they currently have frozen the assets of Financial Resources, CLNM, Scott Fair, Don Dodge, for the properties of lenders they represent. And if we wanted to be added to the list of, you know, potential clients and clearing this up. And they listed Cindy's number and her phone number, her name and phone number. And when I did call them, they were in a meeting about Financial Resources. When I called the Banking Commission, I had spoken to a lady, her name is Nicole, who said that they needed pieces of information. So we included all of our situation and our investor information. We got a call back from Detector Icon. They suggested we call Attorney General Hotline. We got an answering machine and asking for basic information, and they would get back either from the AG office or the FBI to us. Then, when we sent our information to the New Hampshire Banking Department, I got an email back saying, "Good morning, Ms. Johnstone. Thank you for your inquiry. We unfortunately do not have jurisdiction over the matter since you're an investor, not a consumer residential loan borrower." So they in turn referred us to Jeff Spill, the Bureau of Securities Regulation, or Richard Smith at the Office of Attorney General. And that was from Miriam Desfossis. And Shaheen and Gordon also called back and said, "Well, we can represent you, but we need at least a $20,000 retainer to even be considered." Then we received an email from investigator Richard Tracy, saying that they had received my email from my sister, and if I could take a few minutes to answer the questions, you know, feel free to add supporting documents. So we did provide all that information to investigator Richard Tracy. Now, at this point, we did not know where or who to turn to. We were thrown into so many different directions. So when they notified another attorney we knew, Attorney John Ogwin of Portsmouth, he suggested that I go to Belknap Superior Court and get copies of all the suits filed while I was there. While I was there, I received a call asking if we could sign an involuntary bankruptcy petition, that they only needed two more signatures to force FRM and CLNM into bankruptcy. I asked them to call our attorney to discuss. I then received a call from our attorney, Algren, saying that we should do this since we're late in the game, and we should give everyone, meaning all lenders, a better opportunity. So I also, below is a summary that I emailed, you know, to my brother and sister, kind of surmising the conversation. And it says, "I received a call from Attorney General Richard Head, who works with Detective Richard Tracy. And he asked if we were working with an attorney. I gave him John Algren's name. From what I understand it to be, they, the Attorney General, were looking for two more plaintiffs to have the numbers needed to put FRM and CLNM into bankruptcy. I referred him to John since I'm not familiar with the process or the terms. John Algren called back to say he highly recommended that we do this and asked if my father-in-law and Mark and I would agree to it. I said yes. I wanted to be assured that my sister and my brother were named, you know, if they weren't named as plaintiffs, would they still be part of the package? Because I wanted to make sure that they were, you know, they said everybody would be taken care of. So I just wanted to make sure that they were as well. And he said, yeah, we only need two more signatures. He said, absolutely, we just need two more to get the process started. Then the Attorney General will be in touch with everyone that they have been dealing with. John Algren does feel that this is a pretty good chance of recouping some of our investments after they liquidate all of Scott and Doug's assets. Now, with these companies being put into bankruptcy, we pretty much all become equal. And John felt this is the lesser of two evils since we are a bit late in the process. But it also guarantees we're not at the bottom of the barrel, which is where we could be considering 10 or more files had, 10 or more have already filed since Monday. When the AG asked me at the beginning of the week my experience with investments, I kind of laughed and said, me personally, I have no comment, but on behalf of my husband, yes, we're very well versed and educated in investments. Anyway, so we went back and we were asked to please hurry up and sign and fax it back to Peter Roth, followed up by mailing this information, U.S. mail, to Peter's office. So we faxed it back on November 20th. That was all in a matter of about 4 hours, that they were very urgent. We later received an airline. Did I give you copies of the letters from the bankruptcy?
The very last section of the documents you provided me is everything that I have related to the bankruptcy.
Okay.
Including emails and some letters.
I believe I've seen the petition.
Right. I didn't we honest to goodness did not realize that it was just my husband, myself, and my father-in-law.
Well, that was going to be a question of mine to you. I mean,
no, they told us we only needed two more. We were looking at the best interest of everybody involved.
Okay. Your quote to me is that somebody from the Attorney General's office said to you, quote, we need two more.
Right.
Did you assume when you heard that there was a class of petitioners?
Yes.
Here, and you were going to join that class and you would simply add to the number to reach some minimal
exactly.
Number acceptable to the bankruptcy court?
Right.
Is it fair to say in my review of the petition for the bankruptcy court that you are the only two petitioners aside from officials in the state of New Hampshire?
Yes.
And
when we received the documentation, we noticed it was just our names and Peter Hildreth.
And is it absolutely fair to say that that is not what you anticipated?
Absolutely. Absolutely, they had indicated they only needed two more signatures and that this was going to benefit everybody involved. And that was...
And this all occurred, as you just testified, within a matter of 4 hours?
Within a matter of about 4 hours. Because I was at the courthouse at like noontime, and I have a thing saying the attorney had notified me as well, saying, yes, go ahead and do it. So I had to rush back to Durham. My father-in-law had to rush from Stratham, and we met in Dover because Peter Roth said he had to have this in by 5 o'clock.
Was it Peter Roth who said to you, quote, we need two more?
That was, I think it was Richard Head that said that.
Okay.
They need two more, but Peter Roth is the one that, that he had us fax it to him. And he's the one that, in my email, in all the stuff that was signed, it was Peter Roth that actually took over the process of it, and we dealt with him.
At what point in time in this process did you actually see the petition to the bankruptcy court that contained just your name?
Well, when they sent us the documents to sign, they just had our names listed along with our attorney. So I guess that would have been the first time, but the first time we realized it, that we were the only ones, was when it was in the paper the next day. And it was in the newspaper. And at first we were like, oh my gosh. I wonder if it's because it's a local newspaper that they only mention local people. And then it wasn't until we received, the documents in the mail stating that, you know, when we saw just our names in Peter Hildreth. Peter Hildreth's name.
And that is not what you had anticipated you had joined, is that correct?
That is correct.
I want to back up a little bit, and I don't mean to cut you off if you have more that you want. Okay. I'd like to back up into your original introduction into the world of FRM and CLNM. Refresh my recollection. How did that occur?
That occurred when, after my mom and dad had passed, we all inherited money. So a family friend had recommended financial resource that was involved with financial resource.
And did you call FRM?
Yes.
And who did you speak with?
Scott Fair in January 2006.
You also mentioned in your opening remarks that you called the Better Business Bureau and you recall them saying something about A+.
A+ rating.
Okay. Did you talk with any state agencies at all?
No.
Did you do any internet search of any kind of FRM or Scott Farah or Donald Dodge?
Yeah, we actually did with Scott Farah, and that actually, I should have put that in the opening statement, and that's when we realized information about his dad in the church. So we asked Scott for clarification. He said it was nothing that ever was prosecuted, and it was false information.
Explain that to me.
Sure. When we had done a Google on Scott Farah's name, it came up that years prior that he and his father, and the name escapes me.
That's okay.
Robert Farah were involved with the church and taking people, investors' money. And I don't remember the exact story. They had invested some of the parishioners' money illegally, or I don't know.
No, just from your recollection, is it fair to say that you found an issue
concerning
the father and the son?
Yes.
And the man, in the way in which they managed other people's money.
So we had asked Scott about that.
And what was his response to you?
That it was never prosecuted. They were never found guilty, and it was a big misunderstanding.
Okay, and you accepted that.
Yeah, I accepted that. And he said, we've been in business, you know, for a long time, and I can tell you in 2 years there were only 2 foreclosures and the people got their money back.
Okay. One thing that was particularly interesting to me in your opening statements is that you quoted someone at FRM. I think I know who, but I want to be absolutely certain. And the quote was, based upon an inquiry you made to them, the quote was, you are considered the bank, meaning you, Polly Johnstone.
Right.
Who said that?
Scott. Fair.
So he clearly indicated to you that you would be in the position of a lending institution.
Yes. Yes. So I didn't even have my little scribble notes.
That's okay.
Got it.
That's okay.
I had to go back
through
everything.
Just relax.
Yeah.
So is it fair to say that your understanding of your relationship with FRM and CLNM at all times was that you would be lending through them to other individuals?
Yes.
Is it fair to say you viewed them like a broker?
Yeah. You mean them being considered like the middle people?
Yes.
Yes.
At any time, did you think any of the monies that you advanced to FRM or CLNM was going to be used for the operation of FRM or CLNM?
Not at all.
Did you think in any way that you were investing in either one of those entities?
No.
Did you feel that your sums advanced were going to be secured in some fashion?
Yes.
And how did you think they were going to be secured?
From the documentation that we received.
And who did you receive the documents from?
From CLNM and... From CLNM, mortgage security agreements and assignments, listing us as the as the lenders.
Okay. In all instances, you were listed as lenders. Is that correct?
Yes.
You were considered investors in any way?
No, we were considered lenders in all of our.
And that's what you considered yourself?
That's what we considered ourselves. So we thought, if worst to worst, if anybody defaulted with a loan to ratio, a loan to value ratio, that we could at least either have property or our money back.
Bear with me. Oh, I'm interested in the second mortgage transaction. I think that was a on Tangway property
mm-hmm.
in Concord, and it was, I think, a $25,000.
The second mortgage, you were listed as a second.
And you felt adequately secured even though you were listed as a second?
Yes, we did.
Why did you feel secured?
Well, it was supposed to be for a short term and had a higher interest of return, and we didn't actually have any information on the first lender, so we thought it was, I mean, we, I don't know, it was basically my husband that on that part of that, and not as much on that as I did in the first one.
Did you believe first that you were secured by real estate even though you were in second position?
Exactly, yes. Okay.
And did you get some loan-to-value information when that opportunity was presented to you?
Yes, we did.
And did you review that?
Yes.
And you found it acceptable?
We found it acceptable, yes.
What's your understanding of the function of CL&M in these processes you had?
That they were actually the ones that were holding the money. Like Scott would send out the different opportunities, and he kind of managed that part of it. And if we were interested, then it would be the CL&M that held the money and managed the money. So they were working together. It was my idea of it.
Did you ever hear anybody use the words escrow account?
I don't recall.
Okay. Did you attend any of the closings of any of these transactions?
No, we did not.
The closings were done by mail?
Yes.
Are you familiar with the law firm of Gould and Burke?
Did you? Only because of their signatures, but we never met them.
Okay. Did you feel that they were representing your interests in these transactions in any way?
Yes.
And why did you feel that?
Because I actually researched your, when I say research, I just mean Googled. I didn't call or anything. But when I called them, I, you know, found out the information that they've been working in, you know, with Scott, or excuse me, FRM and CL&M. So I assumed that they knew what they were doing, and they had all been in business for a long time. And supposedly there were no complaints against Scott. So I was assuming that they all were on the up and up and had integrity.
You called the banking commission sometime after you returned from Korea, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. In the banking commission, in their conversation with you, I believe your testimony was they indicated they didn't have jurisdiction over FRM?
Right. Because we were considered a lender, not a borrower.
Did they explain to you that they had done examinations of FRM?
No, no.
Would you be surprised to learn that they had done examinations of FRM?
Yes.
Would you be surprised to learn there were problems with those examinations?
Extremely. Yes. You know, and it was just, it seemed like every time we tried to contact them, anything to do with banking, they would refer to somebody else, and they would say, no, we don't have jurisdiction over that. And then that's why everybody was in a complete tailspin at this point, because we didn't know who to turn to, who to trust.
This is subsequent to the November 9th closing of FRM, is that correct?
This is when we got back from Korea on November 15th.
Okay.
But anyway, so nobody knew. So I, you know, going back to signing the stuff in the bankruptcy, you know, that's why we didn't know who to turn to, who to trust, and what is the best for everybody involved. And when the attorney and Richard Head, and now we find out Peter Pilgrim said that that was the best route to go, we did it. You know, but, we signed the bankruptcy.
So is it fair to say that you relied on the advice of senior state of New Hampshire officials before you signed that petition?
Yes. And now looking back, I wouldn't have signed it.
One of whom was a commissioner of banking.
Huh?
One of whom was a commissioner of banking.
Yes, who was it? Yeah. And he, yes, and he was, Peter Hildreth was also listed. It was us and him that put it, you know, and Peter Hildreth that forced the involuntary bankruptcy. So I feel very, like we were coerced into doing it, and we were tricked into doing it, and it was not a good situation. When we look back on it.
Were you surprised to see Peter Hildreth's name on that petition after you had been told that the Banking Commission did not have jurisdiction?
You know what? I didn't really pay attention to it, to be honest. It wasn't until months later that I realized that his name was next to ours, as if we were, you know, in cahoots, you know, that we were all trying to come to the same result. There were so many different people that I had spoken to in the banking department that there were so many different departments, so many different people that I
understand. Your total investments through FRM, total sums forwarded to FRM, $375,000, is that correct?
Yes, I thought it was $425, but I don't know if I added $375, I guess.
And the Mnookin matter never closed in any way?
It never closed, no. And the only documentation that we got from them was saying that they received our check and that, go back to that. And I don't have the letter with me, but sorry about the delay here. That they had received our deposit toward the lending of the Mnookin at 14%, and that we would be receiving 2 points at the closing for the loan. And then we'd start getting 14% of the term. And at the closing, we'd receive a normal per diem payment. And therefore, after that, we'd get regular payments. But it never got that far.
And this was forwarded in October of 2009?
Yes, October 10th. And they cashed our check on October 20th, is when our check was canceled, or cashed.
And that check went to CLNM?
CLNM. Sorry.
Did all your checks go to CLNM?
Yes. Yeah, and I have a copy of all of the checks that we wrote. Okay. $375 is the total.
Well, I have nothing further at this point, Mr. Spill or Mr. Forcier.
Hi, thanks for coming today. My name is Jeff Spill, State of New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. I just had a couple questions for you. We had talked earlier, you and I, about the bankruptcy process, and you mentioned an issue surrounding reimbursement of fees. That you had to pay?
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain that to Mr. Cameron?
Yes, absolutely. After we had signed up, there was a hearing on December 3rd, a bankruptcy hearing, I think it was in Manchester, mm-hmm. And Peter Roth, I apologize, I don't remember exactly whether it was Richard Head or Peter Roth, that came up to me and said, have your attorney call us, because you can be reimbursed for that, because we ended up getting charged quite a bit working with the attorney on it. So he said, just have my attorney call, so he'll know what I'm talking about. So I had sent an email to our attorney saying that, you know, that we would be reimbursed. And could you just make a copy of the invoice that he'd given to us, kind of, and check off everything that had to do with signing the involuntary bankruptcy? So he did, and he forwarded it off to Peter Roth. and Peter, you know, didn't reply, didn't respond. So then about a month later, I forwarded it to him again and said, you know, per our conversation, and I actually, I think in here, are they in here, the copies of the email?
Are you speaking? Yeah, I believe so. Everything
I'm
you gave
sorry,
me.
I'm sorry, you did such a good job organizing. I didn't.
Everything you gave me with respect to the involuntary.
Oh, okay, yeah.
If it's there, I'll find it.
Yeah. Just. Yeah, so so we forwarded off, so he didn't reply, so I called him back, Peter Roth, and he said, no, it's not us, you have to go to the trustees. So then I notified the trustees, and they said, no, it's not us, you have to go to the bankruptcy court, and you have to file. And this went on, I mean, nobody was returning my calls or anything, and everybody was passing the buck for a good, probably 3 months. We still have not gotten reimbursed for it. And that's with that.
I think that's all the questions I have.
Mr. Forsey, do you have any?
Just one quick question.
Sure.
With respect to the Mnookin deal, you testified that it receives solicitation calls from Diane Smith?
Yes.
How often
did
she called you?
Yeah, we have a, I think I may even have a letter from her. But yes, she called us at home probably two or three times. My in-laws, which hopefully they don't mind, I speak on their behalf, they were getting like two calls a day from between Scott and from Diane, trying to get money for the investment. So when we had agreed to do it, and I called Scott and I said, well, we don't quite, I think he was looking for between, I don't remember the exact amount, but I think he was looking for another, I think my brother said 180,000. And between my in-laws, my husband and I, and my brother, I think we were able to, we came up with like 100,000. So I asked Scott, I said, you know, even if you don't get the full amount, you know, this is what we come up with is the deal, because Scott had indicated that the deal wouldn't go through unless he came up with that money by that Monday morning. And I said, well, you know, what happens if you don't get it all? And he goes, oh, don't worry about it, I'll find it. You're all set. And I said, well, I don't want to invest if it's not going to happen. He goes, no, it'll be fine. I'll come up with the money somehow.
When you use the word invest, that means something to me that may not mean something to other people. Yeah. What is it fair to say that what you're saying to me is that if you raised collectively $100,000, your intention was to forward that to FRM?
To lend the money.
To lend the money on a transaction that would be secured with an interest in real estate.
Right. And so, I apologize.
That's fine, but I just want to make that really clear.
Absolutely.
Every time I hear that word, and I use it.
Yeah, we were thinking like on ours, we're looking at it as an investment,
sure.
But it was considered lending money. So we were going to lend the money to Financial Resource, who was going to in turn put it toward the Mnookin project.
I understand. I just want the record to be really clear.
Absolutely.
That. I also want, Mr. Forsey.
No, she answered my question.
Okay. I'd like to return to the very first transaction, the 2006 transaction with Tangway Homes.
Mm-hmm.
As I understand it, that was a 12-month note that you voluntarily rolled over for another 12 months.
Yes.
As I also understand it, at some point in time, you asked to take out some of the principal in this.
Correct.
And that was in 2009, if I'm not mistaken.
That was in August of 2009.
And you were advised that that couldn't happen. Is that correct?
Correct. Because you didn't have somebody to take my place.
Did that
$25,000
give you any pause for concern?
It did.
Did the frequency of calls requesting funds give you any pause for concern?
Yes. Yes, and that's why I was very apprehensive about doing the Mnookin. At that point, I felt like it was a risk. And I also know that my sister had gone through problems with one of the projects that she had lent money to. So it was definitely a red flag at that point. My thought was, if I didn't see anything going out asking for somebody to lend $25,000, And I was part of the email where you could, he would send an email and you could log on with your passcode, which I never did, so I don't even know what my password was. But we also got lending opportunities, and I wondered why, you know, he didn't put me into that lending opportunity for Tangaway for $25,000. I mean, that's how he's going to find people to fill my spot. And that never came out either.
And these questions in your mind started occurring
in August
of 2009.
2009. And then when we got back from Korea, you know, we didn't realize what had happened. And it turned on my BlackBerry, and it was going absolutely crazy with all the emails and phone calls about what happened. And I just, it's almost like you knew that something bad happened. So it was awful, as everybody can vouch for. So my thought was, if, you know, obviously we're in the same position where, you know, you lose your hard-earned money. I mean, just it was just a small portion that was the inheritance, and the rest was just, you know, money that we had worked hard, well, my husband worked hard and earned. And when we were asked to sign to put it into bankruptcy, because it would be in the, I even have newspaper articles stating that that was their intent, is to make this beneficial for the lenders, to be able to recoup some of their money. And I think I may have forwarded on some emails, I'm not sure, but I can forward that on. And that's why I thought, oh good, at least we may be able to get something back. So I felt victimized again.
I think that's clear, I understand that. There is one matter in my mind that I truly don't understand, and that's the May 16, 2007, $100,000 for a project called Good Earth Revocable Trust and a Thomas Gary coin. I don't understand that transaction at all. Can you assist me with that?
Sure.
The relevant document are on the, I believe, the 5th. That one right
there. Oh, okay, yeah.
The last set?
The last set. No, second to last. The last set of the bankruptcy stuff,
yes.
And then the second
okay.
to last.
Okay.
Well, the third to last is the lending opportunity that she received and some information about her protection, but the actual closing documents are right there.
How were you solicited for this particular opportunity?
I'm just trying to look through here to see if there's a lending opportunity.
That was in the packet right before. If you go one tab back, that's everything that you had told me you received as a lending opportunity. The next tab back. That tab that you're looking at now is everything you gave me regarding closing. So if you look at that right there, that you have.
Okay, this is.
That's what you gave me and told me that's what you received as a lending opportunity for Earth, so. Earth Protection.
Oh, right. But the Earth Protection is different than the Good Earth.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. It's easy to mix up.
Yeah. I don't believe you gave me a separate one for that.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I...
I believe we just have the closing document.
Well, let me clarify one thing. The Good Earth Revocable Trust of 2006 involved real estate at Breckenridge Road, Unit 6, Laconia, so that when you forward $130,000... $100,000. You believe that $100,000 was going to be secured by interest in real estate?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And how is Mr. Coyne involved in this transaction, if you know?
He's actually, I think, the other $30,000. The other's 23%, 24%. It should say on the loan master. Burton Klein actually is the other 23%. I assume that Gary Coyne being the contractor, just like Tangaway was for that project at Abbott Village.
What was being developed in this particular project, do you know?
that was assuming it would have been real estate. Double check my. I thought I had everything here, but
well, we know it's real estate, but you don't have a recollection of exactly what that project is.
Right.
That's
right.
That's fair. That's okay. Fine. You don't, I'm not asking you to find one if you don't have it.
Okay. Yeah, I don't recall.
Bear with me.
Being the trustee of the Good Earth Revocable Trust of 2006.
As I understand it, that's excuse me, that's a condominium development in Laconia on Roller Coaster Road. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's okay. Yes.
Was that being built
by Mr. Built
by Mr. Coyne?
By Mr. Coyne.
Did you ever visit that site?
No. But he actually called me during the after the collapse.
And what did he say?
And he said that he was going to do everything in his best interest to, he'd already talked to Klein, the other investor. He's going to do everything in his best interest to sell it and be able to get us our money back without going, but this is before I went into bankruptcy. And he, then he told me on his side that he was also not only a borrower on this project, but he was also a lender, and that he was losing, you know, he lost, I think it's $2 or $3 million. I don't remember the exact number, and that he felt really bad about it and things like that. He was going to try and do right by it, and that was it.
In the closing statement for that particular project, there were two payments to Gould & Burke PLLC and then one payment to Old Republic National Title Insurance Company. Did you ever see a title insurance policy on that property?
No.
Did you ever see any title insurance policies?
No.
Forward any money to FRM or CL&M that was not, in your mind, intended to be secured by a mortgage on real estate?
No.
Okay. I have nothing further. Mr. Spill, Mr. Forsky, do you have anything further?
No, sir.
No, sir.
Is there anything else you'd like to say, Ms. Johnson?
Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you.
And if I think of anything, I'm pretty sure that I was able to go over everything. Thank you again for your time. And thank you for your time. But I think I was able to go over everything. But if I come across anything, then I'll be sure to forward it on.
If in reviewing documents or my notes, if I come across anything that I need to pose additional questions, I will do it through Mr. Spill. If we do that, just remember that you will remain under oath throughout
absolutely
the duration of this hearing process.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right,
thank you very much.
And let's
into yeah. Great. Thank you. Nothing else today?
No, sir.
That concludes the hearing for today. We will adjourn for Monday morning at 10.